Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Ticks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Today is Independence Day for the United States of America, and there are lots of events occurring, and one of them is a two-day event at the Humanist Hall in Oakland, California, and it's an African Unity Day. Because as Frederick Douglass speaks so eloquently in What to the American Slave is the 4th of July, this particular day, July 4th, referencing 1776, the date of the independence of this nation, is questionable when one considers democracy for all Americans, specifically people of African descent. So I am going to play a pre-recorded interview with the organizer and one of the guests for this wonderful Day of Education and Unity for People of African Descent. And I am going to also play an interview with Mr. Dave Dennis, who is one of the architects of Freedom Summer, which was a summer where, 50 years ago, where young people from throughout the country, specifically the North, went to the southern states, Mississippi being one of the most violent, but violence was everywhere, to register people of African descent to vote. And there's a new film by Stanley Nelson entitled Freedom Summer to commemorate those ancestors and to celebrate those who survived that war between the states, the Second Civil War is how I like to term it, to term that particular period in history. So I'm going to play a couple of tunes from Melamay, oh, actually one tune specifically, and then we're going to play some of these pre-recorded interviews. So this one is called African Sunshine.
that we're at a point, kind of in the beginning of the video, we're at a point where some Africans were sovereign on an island, St. John, from 1733 to 1734. They were sovereign because they defeated the Danish.
Really?
They kicked them off the island, and they had it sovereign. The Danish later joined force with the Dutch and the French and the English and, of course, all the other European dichotomy, mm-hmm. and came in, and they waged war on them again. These Africans decided that they will jump rather than and being re-enslaved. So they jumped at this point, at this part of Ram's Head.
Ram's Head, ah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you get the Ram's Head, you want to know how could they have jumped, because you can barely climb up there. The wind is so forceful. So I felt they flew.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, there are stories about our ancestors flying, you know?
Yeah, I believe they flew. That's where exactly I heard the stories before. And when I got to that point,
mm-hmm.
I said to Ras Adetu, we have to film here because somehow they were flying there.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm flying right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, how
so,
awesome.
Yeah.
So what? Tell our audience that I started taping. What's the name of the piece that we're talking about?
The name of it is called Sons of Africa. NUNS, Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You can get it online. It's on YouTube also. It's Sons of Africa, and you could check it out. Basically, I use the word Sons of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I know I mention, and, you know, from time to time, sisters come up to me and they say, you got to also mention the Daughters of Africa, too. And I know, you know, yeah, I should have done that. I should have included some Nzingas and some Harriet Tubmans, et cetera, et cetera. But the meaningful part of the piece is that, like I say, S-U-N-S, is that we all are sons of Africa. We all are shining.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So we have to, you know, look at the examples that were there before us, the lights that were there in different entities, and see how that applied to our lives. So that's basically what it was about, you know. So
mm-hmm.
just wanted to give a shout out to those men who are really like sons in my life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were any of those men that you that we saw images of, were any of them like related to you? Like were
I don't quite remember all the images because, you know, Atitu did a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they all are related to me, yeah.
yeah, as soon as I said that, I was like,
yeah,
of course.
All of them are related to me. But, yeah, he did a very good job on it. You know, I give thanks. His production company is called Boondocks.
Mm-hmm.
Boondocks Films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's been just doing well with it, you know what I mean? Just putting together different projects out there. And Sons of Africa is a signature piece that we work together with.
Right, yeah, and you're a native Virgin Islander, and
I'm a native African via Virgin Islands.
yeah, love that. Thank you.
Yeah,
so when you mention that place where Africans had sovereignty, they were captured, but then they took over.
Yeah, even before Haiti, the story, Bosjebantan say it, you know, the half has never been told.
Mm-hmm.
So even before Haiti in 1733, they were liberated. They were sovereign for at least 7 or 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before. That story is called the Ram's Head 1733 Revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And they captured this island called St. John, which is the smallest island in what we will call now the U.S. Virgin Islands, then known as the Danish West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
Denmark was the last of the European dichotomy to get into the slave trade, meaning they were the most brutalist.
Mm-hmm.
And their laws and bylaws are on the on record. Denmark, right now also, we were axing Denmark for reparations. We started that real strong rally back in 2008, I think. We did a hunger strike led by Shelley Moorhead of ACRA, which is the Organization for Reparation in the Virgin Islands and throughout the Caribbean. Denmark, as I said, was very, very brutal. About 100 yards away from where I live, so I walk with this every single day of my life, Denmark burned 12 African women alive. And this is in 1878. And so we have a celebration for that day every single year in the area of Virgin Islands, which I live at.
What month and what day?
We have a thing called Liberty Day, which takes place November the 1st every year. It's about almost 100 years in celebration now. Basically, it's actually, this is the 1990 year that we speak of. It started by a labor rights organization called the St. Croix Labor Union. And it was headed up by a brother by the name of David Hamilton Jackson, who was in conjunction with, he was married to Caspar Holstein. If anyone knows Caspar Holstein was, he was responsible for bailing the UNIA out of bankruptcy. He was also a self-made millionaire and created the numbers game in New York City. So he was from St. Croix. And David Hamilton Jackson was married to his sister. So he would, you know, send monies for that organization to lobby and get the people together to own property and have land deeds in their hand, actually.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, wow, interesting.
Yeah.
So you're a historian as well as an artist, huh?
I wouldn't like to take, you know, the title of a historian. I think I take my hats off to historians. But I try to keep the story of our people within my music, yes, and within the artwork. So basically, a Jali Kunda would be more comfortable with me saying, or a Griot.
Okay,
know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the Jali, you know, the African term for Griot,
mm-hmm.
They carry the history of the rulers
of
and
people,
of our people.
Exactly.
So yeah, you're a historian. Yeah, because
well, thank you. Coming from you, that's meaningful. I heard the magnitudes of your greatness. You know, so job well done, my great sister.
Santisana. So you write in your bio that that you are soulful roots reggae singer, deeply motivated by a deeper understanding of life, history, and culture, with a sincere desire to help our people find freedom through music. And in addition to your mesmerizing stage presence and captivating voice, your raw vocal talent is most often coupled with issues that you're passionate about, creating a conscious level of music that the people can relate to and support the ting. You have shared the stage with many of reggae's royalty, bringing forth a message of peace. And you're also a founder and lead designer of, is it Mode Africa Apparel?
Mode Africa,
yeah, a conscious clothing brand that merges history, culture, and fashion into each of their unique designs. And and you're also founder and executive director of Beach Fire, an annual concert that showcases local music, art, fashion, held at different beaches throughout the Caribbean. So, so I guess has Beach Fire happened for 2014 yet?
No, 2014 season is set to begin November Thanksgiving weekend, St. Thomas Virgin Island, at a beach that's called Cokey Point. So, which is voted 2012 Beach of the Year, I think it was.
Yeah. So tell me the name of it again.
Cokey Point. That's C-O-K-I Point, P-O-I-N-T, St. Thomas Virgin Islands.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
So we'll be there for Thanksgiving weekend. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So Nefertina Abrams, Royal House of Makeda Productions, an edutainment company, and our brother Melamie Ganja. How do you pronounce it?
Ganji.
Ganji is sort of one of the headliners of the Ubuntu Fakir. Why don't you do the rest of the pronunciation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And basically, those are words from different African languages, which means love and unity and peace. But we can shorten it and just call it the Pan-African Love and Unity Concert.
Oh, well, we can learn how to pronounce the words, too.
Yeah, it may take us a little time, so I don't want to pressure the people too much. They can come to the event on July 3rd and 4th at the Humanist Hall, which is 390 27th Street in Oakland, between Broadway and Telegraph. They can come, and we can all practice it together because I don't have it down packed, actually.
Yeah. So why July 3rd and 4th for this Pan-African Love and Unity concert, and you're going to have it's going to really be really remarkable, you know, besides having this wonderful brother on you know, performing his work. You're going to have, you know, some testimony from an Ethiopian elder. So why don't you tell us sort of the genesis of the Pan-African Love and Unity concert program.
Well, it was kind of a collaborative effort. I have a partner by the name of Sahai Ridley. She's an Ethiopian sister. And the impetus was, at first, there is a large Ethiopian soccer tournament taking place this week in San Jose. And so they've been doing it for 31 years, so it's a pretty big deal. And so she and I are always reasoning about how Africa needs to unite on multiple levels. And so the idea of the show came together, a Love and Unity concert, but it's more than just a show. It's more than just music. We conceived it as a place for people to network, to learn about businesses that they can support, to put names to faces, to build a network, and for it to be a beginning, not the answer to every question, but a beginning, to create a economic base for us to start doing business with ourselves and for ourselves and by ourselves, to know that we can do that. And as, we are as capable as any other community of building an infrastructure with which to serve and, you know, employ and give our people an income. So this is something that we conceived and we kind of ran with, and it kind of ran with itself. But I was really blessed. I had a remarkable meeting. I was at Shashamani Bar and Grill on 25th and Broadway. It's 2507 Broadway. And I was talking about this event, and there was an elder who overheard, and he actually remarked on me because of the way I was dressed, and he said that I look like I'm from Ghana. And that started this whole conversation, because my whole idea for this concert comes from a Pan-African philosophy, which basically involves greats like Marcus Mosiah Garvey and his wife Amy Jax Garvey, as well as the first Amy. It involves people like Kwame Nkrumah. It involves, of course, His Majesty Emperor Haile Selassie, Sekou Touré, Patrice Lumumba, all the people who believed in Africa as a united, you know, continent where we could live well and in unity and in strength and progress and, you know, be a benefit to our people. So that is where, so when he started talking, and he amazed me, and he told me that as a 12-year-old child, he was a part of a group of children who were chosen to plant trees in 1963 at the Organization for African Unity. And he saw His Majesty Emperor Haile Selassie I. He saw Kwame Nkrumah. He saw Sekou Touré. He saw many of the greats. And he shared that memory with me, and I was determined that I would share it with everyone else, because it's a very powerful testimony. You know, I believe our elders are our living books. I believe that we need to listen to them, because they have a life experience that we'll never have. We can only experience it vicariously through them. But their knowledge is wisdom for us to grow with, you know. And so this concert, this really cultural event, was conceived as a place to build upon those great ideas. And that's kind of where it came from.
Yeah, and it's spread across 2 days. So how is it going to be? How is it going to play forward? You know, what's happening on the 3rd and what's happening on the 4th?
Well,
what time do things start?
Well, the doors open at 7, and we hope to go till 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. The admission is $10 for adults. Children are free. It's definitely a family-friendly event, and we want the children to come in and experience us, you know, practicing our culture in a positive way. And basically it's a situation where there'll be libation poured, because we open every ceremony with honor to the ancestors. You know, my mother, Jerry Imani, who also has poured for years for you, Wanda, at the beautiful Maiafa celebrations we have every year in San Francisco. So she will come on the first night, and she will pour. On the next night, it will be Mama Ayana who also pours for the Mayafa. So we have to start with libation. And there will be African dance by the Akili Dance Ensemble. There will be, you know, word, sound, power, spoken word by the one and only Paradise. And, you know, it will go from there. We'll have a singer from Cameroon, you know, and we'll have... you know, we'll have some conscious hip hop. You know, there's definite excitement there. We'll have our roots. You know, Melame Ganji and you know some others will come to bring those positive vibrations through the roots music. And basically, we're just coming together to enjoy one another and to share our culture. You know, there'll be vendors there. You can definitely support the vendors. There'll be clothing, jewelry. You know, you know, we're just trying to give a little piece of the various parts that make us who we are.
And so will each day, except for people pouring libations, be the same?
Well, I wouldn't think so. Because even, like, if I were to give you a step-by-step, you know, layout, I wouldn't even expect it to follow that precisely, you know. It's going to go with the vibration. You know what I mean? It won't be a hard and fast, this. We will have structure because you have to have that, but we're not going to allow the structure to interfere with the creativity or even something the ancestors might plan for us that we can't foresee.
Yeah, I was just wondering, like, for instance, people who might want to catch Melame Ganji and the elder speak, will they be on both evenings?
Well, see, yes, my lecture, because the elder is a part of, well, you know, Wanda, that I'm a visual anthropologist, which just means I take a camera and use it to study culture. So I wasn't sure that he would be able to make the show. So I filmed him.
Oh.
So he will be part of a lecture that I will be doing on our historic connection to Ethiopia and what it means to us and what we mean to it.
Nice.
So he's a part of my lecture.
Okay.
So that lecture I plan on giving both nights.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, because, all right. So, oh, that's good. Okay, super. And how did you happen to meet Melame Ganji? Have you been to Virgin Islands?
You know, I haven't been to the Virgin Islands as yet. He says the Virgin Islands came to me. You would say that Ganji and I will put it like this. There was a meeting of purpose and spirit and belief. You know, he's a brother who really loves Africa. And you know that I was raised in, you know, I grew on that. So I love Africa. So anybody who loves Africa with an honest heart and with a lot of passion, I'm going to take to that person. You know what I mean? And I'm going to want to, you know, do things and be a strength to them and them a strength to me. And we just basically build upon that passion we have for Africa as African people. And what can we do in a positive way to uplift ourselves and our homeland? So it was a meeting of purpose that brought Ganji and I together.
Hey, Ganji, you mentioned the Honorable Messiah Marcus Garvey, and this particular year is the 100th anniversary of the UNIA, July 20th to be exact. And and you have been going back and forth, Nefertina, to Jamaica over many years, you know, making this film, which I'm looking forward to. One day I will see it. and now you're working on another project. But before we shift to talk about, you know, your traveling to Barbados to do research over the next few months, why don't you talk about, both of you talk about Marcus Garvey and the UNIA and that model of African self-determination as well as Umoja.
Yes. That definitely. Anyone who knows me, and you know me well, Wanda, you know that. I absolutely love Marcus Garvey. Marcus, the first flag I went under was the red, black, and green. So See, it's the one thing to have a philosophy for our upliftment. Many people have had that. I can give you a good speech on how I think we should be uplifted, but if I don't put practical means in place, it's not going to work. The thing that I think makes Marcus Garvey stand out among many leaders that we've had is that he actually put practical means in place. You know, if people are hungry, you have to give them a way to eat. If people are unemployed, you have to give them employment. So the thing that I feel makes him stand out is he always had, it wasn't just like some far-off fantasy dream, he had practical means for us to uplift ourselves, and the economics are central to that. We have to have economic structure central to uplifting our people, you know. Mm-hmm. And so doing for self is integral to that. Emoja is unity. We're stronger together than we are separately. You know, if we get together, all of us, and we all have a dollar, we're all hungry. You can't really buy much with a dollar. But if 10 of us put the dollar together, that's $10. We could figure out some rice and beans or something, mm-hmm. you know. So it's kind of as simple as that. His philosophy was that you do for yourself. You don't wait for anyone else, and that you come together and you unite. And with that power and that purpose, you can accomplish anything, and he showed that, because the UNIA wasn't just a national organization. It was international. It had offices all over the world, and people still remember him. In doing my research for my documentary, which is why it's taking me a while, because I have to travel to all those places he's been, like Costa Rica, all over the place. I want to walk in his footsteps, and I want to see what those seeds he planted, what still remains, and there's a lot. There's a lot that still remains. There are still people all over the earth who remember him, who remember what he did, and who are employing those same philosophies and methods to try to do the same thing, because he would say, what you have done before, you can do so again. You can't just live in the past and feel like, you know, that was some greatness they did. Because they did it, we have to know that we can do it too. You know, so that's kind of my take on him, is he's my example for do for self, for get up and do it, and what you've done before, what you've seen done, you can definitely do it again. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to let Gaju give his take on Marcus Garvey.
I mean, she done said it all, right?
Well, no, because you mentioned when we were talking about the Ram's Head and St. John, you mentioned a person, Casper.
Pastor Holstein.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Pastor Holstein. Mm-hmm. Basically, when Marcus Garvey came to Harlem, New York, mm-hmm. he met a brother by the name of Hubert Harrison. Mm-hmm. Hubert Harrison is from St. Croix, Virgin Islands. St. Croix, or the Virgin Islands, had a level of intellect in the 1800s because, for instance, let's mention, let's take place with Wilma Blyden, for instance. He wrote the book Africa for the Africans, right? Mm-hmm. That philosophy Marcus Garvey took and made practical. Wilma Blyden also was the first ambassador to the U.S. from Liberia. He also, you know, did a lot of the same practical means that Marcus Garvey, you know, wrote about, spoke about, and did with the UNIA. So Caspar Holstein, being a student also of Wilma Blyden, you know, he himself, when he saw Marcus Garvey, as well as, you know, Hubert Harrison, these guys in Harlem at the time, they all worked together as a black nation. Marcus Garvey had the natural instinct to see, let's organize this and let's make this work for us. And so the practical means of these brothers living back then, I mean, one thing is to read it, but then to think about when Hubert Harrison knocked on Marcus Garvey's door, or vice versa, or they met at a grocery store, whatever the case may be, and they said, hey, we need to be owning this grocery store. And then he says, yeah, we need to own this grocery store. How are we going to do it? It's back to what she said. Well, let's put this $10 together here, and this $10 here, and this $10 there. We do collective economics, which now will help us to sustain our efforts. So now today they coined this phrase, and they call it sustainable living. But Marcus Garvey already said self-reliance. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
So all these guys back then, all these brothers, like she's saying, they did it, and if they did it then, we can do it now. You know what I mean? The Haitian Revolution, the same thing. You know, it was a group of brothers. It's not just the Toussaint. It's not just the Dessalines. It's not just the Capo Lenoir. You know what I mean? It's a group of brothers and sisters, yeah. And sisters, of course. There's always a group of brothers and sisters. There's always a group of brothers and sisters, yeah.
Well, you think about, you know, Bukman, and you think about Mam Fatiman,
mm-hmm.
you know, and their call to the Africans in Haiti, like, you know, come to the mountain. Let's consult the ancestors and see what
mm-hmm.
we're going to do about this.
Mm-hmm.
And the call was, free them all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a little modern way of putting
mm-hmm.
it, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
And they went to war and they liberated the African people.
Mm-hmm.
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 Yeah.
Set up the first constitution, first social security system, right there on that little island,
yeah.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we know that we, you know, have always strived for greatness and we always have captured greatness, you know what I mean? So it's good to reflect on those suns that have shined bright, and then we need to now take that same light and put it in our life and let it shine, because there are those yet to come.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that they're going to ask when they see the lack of greatness is, what were they doing?
Mm-hmm.
And then when they decide, hey, we want to be great and we want to do something, and then someone amongst them say, but, you know, those before us, they did this or they didn't do this, they're going to say there's no excuse for the lack of greatness.
Yeah, I was looking up Edward Wilmot Blyden, and he was born, his birthday's coming up next month, 3rd
yeah.
of August, 1832,
mm-hmm.
St.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas, Danish West Indies, now U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Virgin Islands, and
mm-hmm.
And then he made his transition to the ancestors
mm-hmm.
realm February 7, 1912, and he was 79, and he
mm-hmm.
lived in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there is like, man, there's so much there insofar
mm-hmm.
as the connection between Sierra Leone.
Edward Wilmot Blyden, it's so funny because,
mm-hmm.
you know, we even have the dates that, and you go to St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, where he was born,
yeah.
and the streets are named in Danish names. And,
oh, really?
Krongade or, you know, all kind of Danish names that we don't know how to pronounce, because the Danish never gave us an educational system that taught us Danish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we don't never, there are very few African people that knew to speak Danish. If they spoke Danish at the time, maybe people like Blyden and different, there are a number of different people. There were about 5,000 free men
mm-hmm.
and women in the Virgin Islands. They were free.
Mm-hmm.
They were merchants. They were free black men and women. And they had merchants and different businesses and things like that. They were not slaves. They were not owned by any Danish masters, whatever the case may be. They came from all over the diaspora, and they lived in mainly St. Thomas, because St. Thomas had a harbor, a port, that the rest of the world would access. Up to this day, it's one of the world's busiest harbor. The island is 32 square miles, but the harbor is very busy.
Mm-hmm.
There are ships in and out every single day. So because of that, you had a lot of free black men and women that would come there as merchants.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew how to read, write, speak different languages, you know, and they knew how to trade, et cetera, et cetera. So just like Wilmot Blyden is from St. Thomas, Denmark Vesey
mm-hmm.
is from St. Thomas also.
Seriously? Really?
Yeah.
Wow,
yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Denmark Vesey's from St. Thomas. He actually used to do a lot of trade between Haiti, North and South Carolina, Georgia, and the Virgin Islands. His name was called Denmark Vesey after a ship, a Danish ship, vessel. He was on a Danish vessel, so his name, this captain called him Denmark Vesey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they also, when I was reading about Edward Wilmot Blyden, he is actually called the father of Pan-Africanism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hubert Harrison, another native son.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, born April 27th, 1883, and made his transition December 17th, 1927.
Mm-hmm.
He was, besides being West Indian American writer, orator, educator, critic, and radical socialist political activist based in Harlem,
mm-hmm.
New York, because he was described by activist A. Philip Randolph as the father of harmon radicalism, and by the historian Joel Augustus Rogers as the foremost Afro-American intellect of his time, and then John G. Jackson of American Atheists described him as the Black Socrates. So it's like, but he actually edited Marcus Garvey's Negro World.
Yeah, he actually, when Marcus Garvey came, like that's what I was saying. Imagine when he knocked. When we look at their work, we're like, oh, wow, these guys are so great. But I'm talking about how they were socially with each other. Imagine when Marcus Garvey knocked on his door to say, did you finish editing it yet? You know what I mean? Imagine that. And he's like, brother, I'm almost there. I have this, this, and this, that to do. But you are priority because this is serious work. You know, could you imagine how they were interacting with each other when it comes to their passion, which was to free their people? To liberate them, to raise their vibration, raise their thought, their thinking, and I mean raise them to the great people that they are, to remind them how great they were and how great they are to this day. So, you know, that's how I look at the whole thing. When I found out all these brothers from the Caribbean, from North America, from Africa and everything, they all came into Harlem, this melting pot, and they started to work cohesively together so that today we can be here telling this story. Because if we don't leave our intellectual property, then we don't leave ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And he actually, Harrison was, he contributed to the UNIA's 1920 Declaration of the Negro Peoples of the World. Yeah. And it's interesting how.
And that was in Madison Square Garden, right?
Yeah. And it's just interesting, though, how, you know, these various intellectuals, particularly Harrison, from what I'm reading right now, worked with Garvey but weren't necessarily 100% for what he stood for, but they could still work together, which is a model that we don't have to agree on everything to be able to work together. Because that's what people
think now. We don't have to agree on everything, but we have to work on something.
Yeah, right. Well, we have to agree on, you know, sort of the principles. I mean, in this case, the liberation of black people, you know, we have to agree that black people are being attacked. You know, in this case, you know, there was like the lynchings were still happening more so than now. I mean, people were still being lynched in a variety of ways, both physically and psychologically and spiritually. But I mean, there were areas where they could agree, and that's how Harrison was able to continue to work with Garvey, even when you know, he didn't necessarily, let's say, think that Africans in the diaspora needed to go back to Africa. You know, he felt that, you know, we need to establish a claim here in this nation because we built it.
And that, Wanda, is kind of like the same argument between Du Bois and Garvey. And even in the end, you have Du Bois going and repatriating to Ghana. So all it does is to show you that a person's thinking can change over time and information can change your teaching. And really, I don't think it's necessary. Like, I personally do want to repatriate to Africa, even if it's not living there all the time. But sometime I do want to be able to live on the land of my nation. I want to live in Africa at different times. But I don't feel that every African has to feel the same way that I do. I don't think that level of groupthink is necessary. I think that the basics of what we can stand for is sufficient. I don't have to agree with how someone worships. That's personal to me. You know, I don't have to agree with, and I don't agree. Marcus Garvey himself said that every person wouldn't be fit to go back to Africa anyway. But fit or unfit, I just feel it's a personal choice. I think that, you know, people should have the freedom to choose, but I think that in terms of rehabilitating our people and our homeland, I think that's something we should be able to agree upon. I think, and even in the thing agreeing that we deserve reparations for the suffering that we have been through, I think that is something that we should agree with. I think that, you know, the whole reparations movement is very important to us.
It's important to the Japanese.
And, you know, I think it's important, and even leaning into the research that I'm doing in Barbados, which you alluded to, I will be going to Barbados for 2 months, and I'm going to be studying the institution of slavery on that island. And in doing, you know, research as to how I'm going to lay out my project, which will be a documentary, we came upon some records that shows our own ancestor being enslaved on that island. So my research has taken on a very personal aspect, although I find the subject of slavery to be a personal one anyway, and I'm very attached to that. A large part of my research is focused on what that was, because I feel that, you know, as Ganji said before, half the story has never been told, and I feel like our ancestors, their voice is not heard clear enough as to what their experiences were, what they've been through. I don't feel that the world itself has acknowledged the travesty that Africans, the enslavement of Africans, was, and how it continues to impact our well-being today. And I am honored to have Sir Hilary Beckles, who is going to be the narrator on the documentary I will be doing in Barbados. He is also the chair of the Reparations Task Force, where heads of 15 Caribbean nations are demanding reparations from Europe for the, you know, enduring suffering that has been inflicted during the Atlantic slave trade. So, you know, there's a 10-point plan that they've unveiled through CARICOM, and one of the things they're trying to do, they have a list of demands. One of them, which I think is very interesting, is that, you know, some type of agreement is made with countries like Ghana and Ethiopia to offer citizenship to the children of the people from the Caribbean and the Americas who return to Africa. Mm-hmm. And it should be noted that about 30,000 have already made the journey. But the lack of citizenship rights for themselves and their children causes a lot of difficulty, mm-hmm. you know, that needs to be resolved, you know. They want economics addressed because there's an enduring legacy of poverty that was caused by enslavement.
That's right.
We can all see the results of that today, just in the same way slavery enriched Europe and America. You can see the legacy of that enrichment. There are many things... just like there's a documentary on the largest slaveholding family in the U.S., they don't happen to be Southerners. They're actually Northerners.
Right. Yeah.
And it's the
Traces of the Trade, Katrina Brown.
Exactly. Traces of the Trade, a great documentary for everyone to look at, because it shows you that slavery was an institution that benefited the North just as much as the South. You know, the North benefited through merchandising. They sold a lot of the accoutrements that allowed slavery to flourish, a lot of the machinery, you know, a lot of the things, the supplies they needed, as well as there were slaves kept in the North as well. The whole 12 years of slave story comes from a man from the North, a black free man who was kidnapped and enslaved. So slavery is an overarching issue that continues to impact our lives unto this day. So, you know, Sir Beckles is part of the charge. You know, he's a historian, and he's the president of the University of West Indies in Barbados, and he really feels that, you know, reparations is due. Mm-hmm. And he's written several books, and so now he's leading the charge to, you know, demand reparations. And I, it's something that I completely agree with, and I'm very excited to be working with him on my latest project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. Yeah. And when you mention, you know, people don't necessarily think about the North, Northeast specifically, around the enslavement of African people. And we think about names of trailblazers and formerly enslaved Africans like Sojourner Truth, who spoke the Danish language because she was enslaved by, you know, Danes, which, you know, the same people we think about, Trinidad,
See. You can look at somewhere like Curacao, where I visited, mm-hmm. you know, and they still, you know,
Dutch.
Yeah, the Dutch. They're you nice. Can you mm-hmm. can see the effects. You know, you see, there's a great movie that Danny Glover is a part of about, you know, the revolt on there, a famous revolt that took place on Curacao mm-hmm. with his brother by the name of Tula. And it's just when you even on that island, you can still see the effects because those Dutch people are still, they own about 90% of the island. They own the businesses, and there's a huge mixed race population.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the bottom are the Africans. Now, that's whether you were born there, whether you came from Jamaica or somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You're still going to be part of the servant class.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more of like the atmosphere reminded me of something I would recall from the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then when you think about Harriet Tubman, whose name was called earlier in our conversation,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, she was in the North, and so
yes.
was Frederick Douglass. He was in the North.
Yes.
They were not.
Exactly.
I mean, it was horrific there, too. People think, you know,
yes.
if you can imagine, people would say you don't want to get sold down South as if
right.
the North was good. I mean, it was horrible all around. I mean,
it was just a devastating, it was an inhumane, you know, it was torturous, it was murderous, it was devastating, it destroyed families, you know, and those voices of those people have still yet to be heard. Some people feel that we talk about slavery too much. I'm one who doesn't feel that it's talked about enough.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Personally.
I agree with you. Those stories,
yes.
particularly when we get those personal stories, because when the
yes.
They had the government was the WPA project when
yes.
people went around and interviewed formerly enslaved Africans.
Yes.
The people who were doing the interviewing were not African people.
No,
so,
they were not.
So the story that they got was people didn't feel comfortable telling these white people
no.
what happened to them. So a lot of times you read these stories, you know, the transcriptions or listen to the the taped conversations or interviews, and people are celebrating and trying to find some good within this
mm-hmm.
horrible and horrific system, and
absolutely.
As opposed to if they were talking to a brother or sister whose
right.
ancestry reflected theirs, might have had a whole different story.
Yeah, there's definitely some sanitizing
mm-hmm.
taking place there. You know, though some gritty ones were able to get out. You know,
oh yeah.
Some gritty ones were able to get out, but it's still not like half the, you know, story. It's really not. And like some, you know, even among our own people are like, well, you know, it really upsets me. I don't want to see 12 years of slave. I want to see stuff about us being kings and queens. Yeah, I do too. I mean, I'm a filmmaker, so you must know that I want to see stuff about us in a futuristic sense, you know, in the glory of the past and the promise of the future, all those things, but at the same time, I would never dishonor my ancestors by saying I'm tired of hearing their story or I can't take or it's too emotional, because my thing is this. If they could live through it, I could certainly bear witness to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the least I can do.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The least I can do is bear witness, and if it makes me cry like some of it does, I cry. I'm supposed to cry because we're socialized to feel emotion for everyone else but ourselves. You see women, they'll cry about a fictitious character on a soap opera whose love life isn't going well. They'll cry for Erica Kane. But you won't cry for, you know, you don't want to hear about Harriet Jacobs'
mm-hmm.
narrative of a slave girl. It's too much for you. It's too traumatic because you're socialized to be numb to your own experience. It's kind of what I call the mammy factor. You're socialized to care about someone else's well-being, existence, happiness, and pain over your own. And when you brought up, you know, the Queen Mother Sojourner Truth, I thought of something that I read of hers long ago, and I'll never forget it for the rest of my life because I'm a mother. I'm the mother of four sons, and I love them dearly, more than life itself. I remember her saying, she said, someone asked me, did I love my children? And I thought, I must have loved them, though I dare not show it for fear that it would be used against me. So I always think of those words, and as a mother, because I'm very affectionate with my children. I'm very affectionate. I love their skin, their hair, their eyes. I love kissing them, hugging them, touching them. Everything about them I love. I couldn't imagine what would that have been like for me to be afraid to show that I love my child for fear that someone would use it against me, to force me to do something against my will or threaten to sell them or kill them or something. But that is what Sojourner Truth is talking about, the studied detachment that African women had to have to protect their children. And I see some of that under what Dr. Joy DeGruy calls the post-traumatic, you know, slave syndrome, where sometimes people may look at us and feel like, you know, they're very cold or this or that. They don't understand the history and the experience and how those same things. They just did a study to show that memory is passed down through your DNA. So a lot of the suffering, that's why when we do the libation, when I do a libation, I always ask for intergenerational healing, because many of the things we experience, feel that we're going through, that's been handed down through our bloodline. There's suffering. There's hope. There's sadness. There's joy. There's all these things that have been handed down through us, and a lot of trauma from the inhuman treatment that our ancestors experienced, which repeats itself today in cases like Trayvon Martin or Oscar Grant or Renisha McBride or Ayanna Jones or Sean Bell, or so many names, and names that we don't know because they didn't get in the press.
Mm-hmm.
We're still being traumatized to this day. You know, so.
Yeah, wow, you said so much, and I've been taking notes. I wanted to mention something about Sir Hilary McDonald Beckles. It's McBeckle. It's not. It's really, did I have it wrong? McDonald Beckles is how it's. I'm fine.
Oh, they have that there. Okay.
Yeah, but he was knighted. And I was just noticing, because I know the sir means that he was knighted. So he was knighted in 2007.
Uh-huh.
And where is the University of Hull?
The University
of Hull, H-U-L-L, Hull, the University of Hull, where he got an honorary doctorate.
You know, it's probably in Europe somewhere. I don't really.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know the fullness of that one. When I get to Barbados, mm-hmm. and you interview him, he would be the best source for all of that.
Yeah.
He'll be a better source for that. I'm not an expert on,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
that aspect of the knighting or the, you know.
Yeah, I was just reading about him, and he's like, wow.
He's tremendous, right? Is he totally awesome or
that's,
what?
Well, that's where he went to school, the University of Hull,
and
he got a PhD in the Department of Economic and Social History there before he joined the University of West Indies as a history lecturer in Mona, Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a young man. His birthday is, you know, coming up next month. Got a lot of great folks born in August.
I'm telling you, right? My own son is one of them. Asaja, August 6th.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, nice,
yes.
Nice.
I have my own August, you know. Both my grandparents were in August. My mother's parents are both Leos, if you can believe that. Now you see why they produced her, right?
Yeah, and then your mother, when she tells the story of Megar Evers, you know, that's just wow, that is your mother's from Mississippi.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just for her to just tell her story. Have you made a film about your mother just all by herself? I know you filmed her.
Yes, I have.
Oh.
I haven't made it, and I'm glad you put that seed in me, because I have to, you know, I get kind of crazy with this filming thing, because some things, everything is so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything is so interesting. Like, I'm even interested in filming an ecological piece,
mm-hmm.
and even on you know, indigenous knowledge, like how did our people deal with the terrain when they were taken from Africa and they were put in the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
and they were put in North America. How did we deal? Because we came with knowledge. A lot of people are ignorant to the fact that when they were enslaving our people, they weren't just enslaving a blank slate. that they wrote what they wanted on it. They were enslaving people with history, talents, cultures, thing they brought with them. And they would purposely enslave people from different regions. Like if they were growing rice, they would go enslave Africans who knew how to grow rice, who had been growing rice for thousands of years. Tie-dyeing with the indigo. They made use of things we already did. It wasn't like they taught us things. We were doing things in Africa already. So they took us from Africa and brought us over here to do those things to their financial benefit.
Right, right. Yeah, they would specifically target communities where people knew how to grow rice or do metal work or raise, you know, horses. I mean, it wasn't a random kidnapping thing. It's like, we want this kind of expertise, and they will go target those particular communities. So it's even worse.
They took people with talent, and see, that's the fallacy. That's the fallacy that we definitely have to correct, because the narrative they give is that they found these people close to monkeys, scratching in the dirt, doing nothing, kicking gold around, not realizing the value. So they realized the value. And they took these savages and gave them something to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's their narrative. That's not how it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were people like a Benjamin Banneker. There was cosmological knowledge that we had. There were things he was taught by his father, who had been taught by his grandfather. You know, they allude to him having Dogon heritage. And the Dogon were the cosmologists. The Dogons brought the knowledge from Kemet to West Africa of the stars. There's a lot of knowledge that came with us from Africa. It wasn't all wiped away like people believe. My studying as an anthropologist, I'm beginning to get into archaeology. When you follow the evidence, you'll see. There was African knowledge that remained that we kept. They would put it in things like quilts. They would put it in things like songs. There were things that we did. You know, but maybe the succeeding generations forgot. You know, that beautiful movie, Daughters of the Dust, shows some of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kept, there are a lot of what they call retentions from Africa that we kept. Many times my continental brothers and sisters will come upon me and express much shock and dismay that there are certain things I know and certain things I do. And I tell them, well, this was handed down within my family. And then they'll tell me, well, you know, you do this like we do, such and such. So there's a lot that we have that we don't know we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So July 3rd and 4th is the first annual Ubuntu Fakir Simunye.
Yes.
Pan-African Love and Unity Concert at the Humanist Hall in Oakland, 27th and Telegraph. But what's the actual address on 27th Street?
The address is actually 390 27th Street, Oakland 94612. It's between Broadway and Telegraph. Across from, there's a little fire station right across from it. It's a brown building. It's pretty popular because the Humanist Hall is where a lot of events take place, like fundraisers for Haiti and different things. So many people are familiar with it. It has a flag with the earth on it.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And you said the doors open at 7 o'clock on both evenings, right?
Yes, they do.
And it's $10 for adults, and children are free, and it's a
child-friendly
event, so it's 7 to 1 a.m., 7 p.m. to 1 a.m., both.
Yes, people come, stay as long as you want, and leave when it's comfortable for you.
Yeah, and so we're looking at African liberation, huh?
We're definitely, it's about African liberation, and it's about unity. It's about love, peace, and joy, light.
Mm-hmm.
Happiness, it's about sharing and caring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about experiencing different aspects of who we are, learning, you know, the best of who we are.
Mm-hmm. And it's about sort of developing, if people are already connected, an economic base for our people, for our community.
It's about shining bright forever and ever. Move away the dark clouds. So shine your light so bright, sons of Africa.
That was a little special given by Melamed Ganji.
Yeah.
Just for Wanda's picks, just for Wanda. That was just for you.
Yeah, and when you were doing that in the video, I'm like, how is he doing? It's like a bird song.
Yeah.
Mhm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's his. He's.
How am I doing it in the video? I'm lip syncing it in the video.
Well, this was live for sure.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It was live and in person. Well, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity.
Oh, you're welcome. Looking forward to, I think I'll come the first night. And,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and just help you inaugurate the first season. I was doing something else, but it's like, this is going to happen. I'm going to do this instead.
Oh, give thanks. Thank you so much, Wanda. You've always been such a great support to myself and my family. So we appreciate you. We love you very much.
Oh, I certainly appreciate you, and I'm looking forward to meeting you, brother, and hearing you sing live.
Yes, that's Ganji singing, because Nefertina does not sing.
Oh, yes, we know it's Ganji. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to your lecture, Nefertina.
Okay.
That's going to be so wonderful.
Yeah, I'm very excited, because our elder, he said some things. I mean, I could have started crying when I'm filming it. Like, it was so, we need to hear these things.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like, wow, you know, like I couldn't, like he said so much, and for him to have stood in the presence of all of these great people that we read about, but he actually saw them as a young man, you know, a young boy, 12 year old.
Yeah, that's really phenomenal. Yeah, I was in East Africa last year and got a chance to go to Addis. Didn't get a chance to go to Shashamani. Didn't work out. But I just think it's just so wonderful that King Selassie set aside a place for people from the African diaspora to be able to go. I mean, it's just really wonderful.
Absolutely. See, he knew that in order for us to unite, we have to practice culture. See, people don't really understand how important culture is. If we don't practice it, we can't know it. And if we don't know it, we can't show it. He had this school, and he asked Africans from all over Africa to come and learn together. That way you can work together. That way you can eat some of my food, I can eat some of your food, you can listen to some of my music, we can learn each other's dances. I like that skirt you have on.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have that fabric in my country. You do here, take the skirt.
Mm-hmm.
Here, we'll take this scarf from my country. He wanted that. He wanted that exchange because he knew we would grow to love one another, and you can unite with that love.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And so that is basically what my concert is about.
Mm-hmm.
It is about us practicing the culture together so that we can unite.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and we'll have to talk further about this, you know, the whole idea that I told you about. Yeah, so I'm going to let you all go, and I want to thank you again so much, and I will see you in 2 days.
Yes, my darling. You take care of your precious self, and thank you again.
All right, you take good care. Peace and blessings.
Blessings.
So that was Nefertina Abrams and Melamed speaking about the first annual Pan-African Love and Unity concert evening, and I was there yesterday, July 3rd, and it was simply wonderful. And want to pour libations for Mrs. Frances Dunham Catlett, who made her transition earlier this year, April, this year. And yesterday was her birthday. I think she would have been 106 years old. And on Saturday in Oakland at Now Hall, about 1 o'clock, there's going to be a celebration of her life. She was a wonderful painter, dancer. She was all-around artist and really active way into her later years, into her hundreds. And, she's a wonderful woman. So if you're in the Bay Area, you might want to stop by Now Hall for the celebration of her life. And I want to share with you now. Oh, and also I wanted to mention last night, as Nefertina was giving her lecture on the part of Africa formerly known as Abyssinia, now called Ethiopia. A term called Ethiopianism in the 19th century, and that's really interesting that people were practicing Ethiopianism. Folks like Frederick Douglass and other people were looking at Africa as home and African culture as the first culture. And I didn't know that African Americans actually fought to keep Ethiopia free. That's something that she shares in her lecture. And I didn't know either that Nelson Mandela was supported first by Ethiopia under King Selassie, and he actually went there to train for Mkhonto we Sizwe, which was the armed branch of the African National Congress, and Emperor President Selassie gave him a gun, a firearm, as emblematic of Africa's freedom, South Africa's freedom and liberation. And so it was just really, really fascinating. And she did play clips from her interview with the elder, who talked about being at the inauguration of the African Unity. And I actually saw the building. It's a new building. It's really beautiful in the capital of Ethiopia, Addis Ababa. And, yeah, it's just really phenomenal. And when I was there last year, it was the 50th anniversary of the African Union. So they were having lots of activities. And all around the city, there were these big posters talking about how people need to be proud of being African. And that was just so phenomenal to witness. So I'm going to play a couple of clips just talking about Freedom Summer from the film by the same title, Stanley Nelson's film Freedom Summer, which had its broadcast debut last week, and you can continue to watch it on American Experience for at least a couple of more weeks, so you don't want to miss it. And I am going to be speaking with, I'm going to be playing in a pre-recorded interview, a conversation with one of the architects of Freedom Summer, Mr. Dave Dennis, who graciously had a conversation with me last week, this week. and I keep on saying, that's so bad. Had a conversation with him, and I'm now trying to make it so that I can play it for you. So we're going to play a little bit of sort of the voices of the film, talking about what is Freedom Summer, and there were people that were opposed to Freedom Summer, because Freedom Summer was actually a movement to move folks that were disenfranchised into true democracy. And Stanley Nelson writes, over 10 memorable weeks in 1964, known as Freedom Summer, more than 700 student volunteers from around the country joined organizers and local African Americans in a historic effort to shatter the foundations of white supremacy in what was one of the nation's most viciously racist, segregated states. So we're talking about those southern states, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Florida. Clips I'm going to play now is What Was Freedom Summer?
To me, oh, I'm going down a southern road, and if you never see me again, remember that I had to go.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a militant group in the South with support from other major civil rights organizations, is readying a massive program called the Mississippi Summer Project, a campaign that may have no parallel since the days of Reconstruction.
I'd heard about Mississippi all of my life growing up. But nonetheless, the fact that the people in Mississippi couldn't vote was just a shock, even to me there in Memphis. I thought that it was very important to go to Mississippi and make a statement about the horrors that confronted black people there.
This Ivy League campus is one of the staging bases for an invasion of Mississippi by college students. The students are being recruited all over the United States from Harvard to Hawaii. They will go to live in Mississippi this summer to fight for the Negroes' civil rights.
I first heard about Freedom Summer in the spring of 1964. I saw a brochure on the bulletin board at Drake University, where I was a student, which is in Iowa. And it just caught my eye immediately.
I have been making drawings for corporations and colleges, and my wife, June, felt very deeply about the injustice in the country, as did I. So he decided that I would take my skills as an illustrator and go to Mississippi. I was 20 years older than they were, but I was part of the group.
My job was recruiting. Students heard about the project, either through me or the campus newspaper. Then they contacted us for an interview and for an application.
I'm a junior at Queens College, majoring in anthropology. My schooling so far has been oriented toward history, and I have a good knowledge of current affairs. Finally, I have a good deal of experience with racial and religious prejudices in the North and South. Andrew Goodman.
I have just returned from a spring project on a voter registration drive in Raleigh, North Carolina, where I was filled with an overwhelming desire to clean the rot out of America. All I can say is that it's very important to me that I play my role in civil rights for the U.S., and most of all, for myself. Linda Wetmore.
So that's the, what was Freedom Summer? And some of those voices we heard are no longer with us. Andrew Goodman was one of three men killed during this time. And our guest, Mr. Dave Dennis, was one of the, as I mentioned, one of the architects. And he actually was going to join the young people in their mission. It's just he wasn't feeling well. He's going to tell you about that. And so he spoke to them, and then they left, never to be seen again. Well, never to be seen live again. And there was so much violence and tragedy connected to Freedom Summer. I mean, goodness gracious, libation should be poured for these brave young men and women every day. And the thing of it is, was that prior to Freedom Summer, black people were being killed and beaten in this horrific war of terrorism between black people and the white establishment that did not want black people to realize full citizenship rights, which were, you know, participation in voting as well as electoral rights. So anyway, let me stop talking and play the first part of this great interview, and then we'll be back with a little commentary between this segment and the next. Okay, sure. Well, you know, you're a civil rights activist, community organizer, attorney, you're a freedom rider, field secretary for CORE, co-director of what does COFO stand for?
The Council of Federated Organizations is what it was, but was a conglomeration of civil rights organizations that were working in Mississippi. It began in 1961. It was organized in the fall of 1961. As an organization, as a method for supporting the Freedom Rides. The CORE was still bringing in Freedom Riders, packing the jails in Mississippi. And so it was started by local leaders like Mega Evers, Aaron Henry, who is the state chairman of the NAACP, Carsey Hall, who's attorney, Tom Gaither, who was the field secretary for CORE at that time, were some of the people, Amzie Moore, local leader, who some of the local people there. And then in 1962, what we did is we began to look at ways. We had gotten some money from the Board Education Project. It was the SNCC and CORE.
Mm-hmm.
And how to pull that using the state, that type of mechanism for moving a program around voter registration. So we went to COFO, and they liked the idea, and they developed an arm for voter registration, which Bob and I became directors, co-directors of. And under that was sort of that arm sort of coordinated the project that evolved into Freedom Summer.
Ah, okay, yeah. So how was the conference last week? What were some of the high points, and what were some of the
It was a great conference. Some of the high points, we had about 800 students from across the country, what we call the Youth Congress,
mm-hmm.
From various different youth organizations like Children's Defense Fund, the Young People's Project, the Dreamers, just to name a few. We had about the same amount of adults who were volunteers who worked in Mississippi in 1964, staff people, and then just people who wanted to come and become involved with the movement. Sorry.
Oh, no problem.
And so they came in from all over the country also, and so we... The highlights of what we did for the conferences was to break it up into four different buckets, we call it. One bucket was voter registration, looking at the Voter Rights Act, repeal of the Sections 4 and 5 and the impact it would have on voting rights of people in the country. workers' rights, looking at employment situations in the state of Mississippi and the country. The third one was health care, looking at the issue of health care in the state of Mississippi and across the country. And the other one was education, which was the big focus here, looking at the issue around quality education as a constitutional right, which we were pushing, ways and means and strategies for begin to get the country to raise the bar and provide quality education for all students, and also making it a constitutional right. I mean, there is nothing in the Constitution that addresses people being guaranteed a quality education in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We guarantee equal education under the 15th Amendment, but we do not guarantee quality education. So the issue was there is how do we do that? And what's the threat now, we think, in the country of privatization of education, which is we think is beginning to emerge using the New Orleans model for that. And that's based upon the fact is that New Orleans would become the first major school district in the country that will probably be 100% charter school district beginning in September.
100%? Wow.
Yes, 100%, yes. And over 6% of the teachers on that process would come from Teach for America.
Oh, wow. That's terrible. Wow.
And that based on, and what's frightening about that is that this has been a trend to move this as a model. New Orleans was it's the first city that's been rebuilt almost from the ground up since Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first city in the country to have that. The country been able to do that with since Reconstruction. So in doing this is they developing these models. One is how to restructure cities, and the other one is restructuring the education system, which can impact on the structure of the cities and the economic resources. And so the way they did that is that the Katrina hit in August of 2005.
Mm-hmm.
In October in 2005, the city of New Orleans fired all of the teachers. They had to reapply.
Oh.
And they set up this thing called the Recovery School District model. And they took any schools that were 80% or below in terms of pass rates, they took them over as at-risk schools, which is a very high rate, which means they took over practically all of the school buildings in there, except maybe about a dozen. And so all of a sudden is you got this new system going to places, and we're leaning toward a heavy charter piece. The frightening thing about it is that the second debate between Obama and McCain said in that debate is the model for the future of education in this country is what is going on in New Orleans. Now, McCain did not win. Obama won.
Mm-hmm.
But what's been moving here is this a model, which still is in effect and is taking hold as a model in the country. You have the same. They're moving this model into Detroit, Michigan. He's moving this model in certain areas of California.
Mm-hmm.
And is trying to move not only New Orleans, but it's spreading throughout the state of Louisiana.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and you're from Louisiana, right? Your family is?
Yeah, I'm from Louisiana, from the northern part of the born. I'm actually a product of a sharecropper's family coming
mm-hmm.
out of the northern part of Louisiana. I'm raised about outside of Shreveport
mm-hmm.
in a little place called Cedar Grove, which became part of Shreveport,
okay.
Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my family's from New Orleans.
Well, I spent a lot of time in New Orleans. In fact, is I went to undergrad school at Dillard University, I dropped out when I got involved in the civil rights movement in 1960. In 61, dropped out and became a full-time field secretary in Corps for Louisiana, and then moved into Mississippi in 1962. Went back to Dillard in 1965, and finished there in 1968.
Mhm. Yeah, yeah. Is Dillard a historic black college?
Yes, it is. It's a HBCU. In fact, as I just finished talking to one of their when you called, I was talking to one of their faculty members there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading. I spoke to Mr. John Pierre last week about the conference in Tougaloo, and he sent me an email, and I was reading about Wilberforce, and it's Wilberforce University, and it's possibly losing its accreditation. It's on, it has until December to prove to the accrediting board that it shouldn't lose its accreditation. And that university has such a rich history as a place, you know, where, you know, a station in the Underground Railroad, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, oh, my goodness. And in that same article was talking about another historic black college that lost its accreditation, and I was just wondering, like, what could be done to foster the longevity of these institutions, because, you know, we need to have our institutions be viable and competitive.
Right, but they are all in trouble right now. Is the mm-hmm. It's much more difficult now for black youth to get loans to go to college, and so the Pell Grant
mm-hmm.
situation there is which cut out a lot of support, because these children coming from poor families can't get into college or university. So if your requirement to get into an HBCU is the same as to get into a high-level majority white institution, MWI, then a lot of students are opting out to go to the MWIs because of the fact is that there's accreditation ratings and also there's more money and more resources. So the resources in the HBCUs are dying out, which is very interesting, because under the Ayers case that talks about equal distribution in terms of resources and money, a lot of the money went into HBCUs and state institutions to rebuild and renovate and put in new buildings, which they have a lot of state institutions. Campuses are beautiful,
mm-hmm.
but they don't have any resources. So the schools are dying out, and the states have taken over the schools and for the expansion of the MWI institutions. And so this is having a direct effect, negative effect on the historic black college universities around the country. I mean, they're closing out and talking to Dillard, which is where I graduated from, of course,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, they've taken out the schools of sociology, psychology, they, you know, they don't exist. But they were about to close out the English and math and majors. I mean, but my question was, what the heck are y'all teaching? You know, but the problem is,
yeah.
is that there's a big that has over the past decade or more, several decades, has been a tremendous drain on your top black professors to go to white institutions because they have the money to pay more, to pay them more and more resources for the resources for them to do the research that they're doing.
Mm.
And so that's how they get more accreditation and recognition. And so that's one drain off. And so you in the beginning, the first drain off is of your athletes, you know, and now you drain off the professors. Now they drain off the best students.
Mm-hmm.
So the HBCUs are very much struggling. And so we've been working with them in places is trying to develop this pipeline from the community of at-risk students to be able to go to the HBCUs, but the financial support is not there. And so the this has always been the role of HBCUs, that has been the door for minority students and high-risk, coming from high-risk or at-risk areas, to be able to enter to a college, and four-year college, and get a degree.
Mm-hmm.
When other institutions would not accept them, would not... And also now today is the MWI makes it very difficult for students coming from low-income and at-risk areas to be able to go in. And so we're trying to keep the doors of HBCUs at this time open is very important to the communities of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if you could talk about how you became a part of the movement to bring the South, you know, the member, you know, the citizens in the South into a true democracy, you know, with the Freedom Rides and the Freedom Summer, you know, coming from, you know, a real humble, you know, family, you know, if your father was a sharecropper and then you end up going to university and become, you know, this high-profile world, well, you know, national and world leader just through the example that you and others set around the organizing, because that model has been used throughout the world, you know, grassroots organizing and to bring change to a society. And then laws were passed, like, for instance, tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of the of Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, well, what happened here is that it was by fate alone, you might say. What I did was when I graduated from high school, I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school, to do that. So that was big for my family. And so when I went to college, looking at trying to get a degree in electrical engineering, and going on out and making some money and doing that type of stuff. Because I had no interest in civil rights per se. And to give you an example about that is I graduated from Southern University Lab School because I was staying with my aunt in Baton Rouge. The lab school is connected to Southern University, and the when the students did their walkout in the early 1960s from mm-hmm. Southern University, one of the leaders of that march was a guy by the name of Ed Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And as he passed the university, the high school, his brother and I were standing outside there, and they were closing down the school, and he told us to come join them, and we said no. And I went home with his brother, and we played basketball. And believe it or not, his brother was a guy by the name of Hubert Brown, who later became known as H-Rap Brown. Was my classmate.
Oh, really?
So we had no real interest. So life was sort of taking on its own form with me. And so when I left, graduated from high school, I had a scholarship to go to Dillard University. And so when I got to Dillard, That was students in jail from sitting in, both from Dillard University, from Xavier University, from Southern University of New Orleans branch, from Tulane, and from Loyola. And so there was a lot of talk on campus about what was going on. Is at that time, is I stayed away from it. I don't want to have anything to do with that. Is and really, one day I was walking across campus, and there was a group of students standing in the yard talking to talked to by rather a young lady who was staying on a stoop of bench areas and talking. So as I passed by, I looked up and I saw she was a very attractive lady. So I went back and started talking to her, trying to get a date, and ended up her getting me going to a core meeting instead of going out on, that was my date, I guess. And so I went to this core meeting, and that's how I got began to get involved into the civil rights movement. It was just by luck, by chance, and by fate that I got into it. And then it was that moved into a sit-in whereby luck, you might call it again, is whereby students were going, CORE had a strategy for downtown where they would go to the lunch counter and they would sit in, and the police would come and tell them to move on, and they would get up and they would move on. And so no one would be arrested, but it would cause enough disruption at the Woolworth store or wherever they would sit in at that the store would almost close down. So it was an effective sort of boycott, and they would do it on Saturdays when there was heavy traffic from potential customers. Mm-hmm. Well, this young lady, her name was Doris Castle, talked me into going on one of those, and I thought it was something that I could do and I wouldn't get into trouble. And so I was still trying to get a date with her, but she still was saying no. And so I go down. But on this day, they changed the rules. And so the police didn't give a warning. They just arrested everybody. So I was arrested for both trespassing and resisting arrest. I kept trying to convince them, if you just let me go, you'd never see me again. But mm-hmm. I ended up spending a week in jail. So that was really beginning an orientation. Mm-hmm. Then the real hook to me was that right after that is the CORE began these freedom rides from Washington, the ride began in Washington, D.C. It was supposed to end in New Orleans. The New Orleans group was supposed to be the host. And then, you know, the history of that is, I mean, the bus was bombed, burned, and people attacked in mm-hmm. Anniston, Alabama, and also in Birmingham. And so a lot of the people, some of the people on the bus were injured very badly, but they could not get medical treatment where they were in Alabama at that time is, so they would have to ship them to New Orleans, and that was a black hospital in New Orleans, Flint Goodrich, which was connected to Dillard University. Mm-hmm. So we arranged for them to get medical care. In the meantime, there was this debate going on between young people who wanted the rides to continue. One thing led by Diane Nash and the Nashville movement, a group of young people where you had C.T. Vivian and all those, and John Lewis and others. And so on the other end, in New Orleans, there was this young lady by the name of Aretha Castle who was also demanding that the rides continue and that these members of the CORE chapter in New Orleans wanted to continue the ride. And I got caught up in the frenzy, that is, ended up getting on a train to join the rides in Montgomery, Alabama. And when we got there, there was a mob going on and stuff. So we had this meeting, which was really the clincher for me, where we met practically all night. There was Dr. King, Ralph Abernathy, Y.T. Walker, C.T. Vivian, Diane Nash, Jim Lawson, all the great names in the civil rights movement there. And I'm sitting there debating because I wasn't sure yet I wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. And so we were going back and forth about whether it was one thing. Young people were insisting on that the ride should continue. The question was, well, who's going to be on the ride? And so the elders felt that it was too dangerous for the people to continue these rides. Mm-hmm. So someone in the room made this statement. I don't know who made that statement is, but the statements are like, you know, there's no space, there's not enough space in this room for both fear and God. Mm-hmm. And so that hit me. I mean, I had to me in my head, it was I had to make a choice here, you know, fear or God, because this is all wrapped around the discussion about the commitment and what it means to be free was a means to attack these rules of enslavement, and I had to, you know, make a choice. And so at that moment is, for some reason, is the choice was very easy. It was a no-brainer. And so I ended up volunteering very happily to get on the first bus to leave out of Montgomery going to Jackson, Mississippi on May 21st of 1961. Mm. So after that, it was all over. My life was dedicated to the civil rights movement at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You speak about at the funeral for one of the men that was killed, in that kidnapping.
Cheney.
Yeah, Cheney. About tired of going to funerals, being tired of going to funerals, and you lost a lot of loved ones and friends, during this war, and I sort of look at this. The civil rights movement as like the second civil war, in this country, and I was just thinking about, your close relationship with Megger Evers, and then when you were talking about the Freedom Rise, I was thinking about Bayard Rustin, and then when you mentioned, your friend, and you said his name is H. Rap Brown, who's now Imam Jamil Al-Amin, who's in prison, and he's really sick. And just think about, the other movements that came sort of spun off of that particular movement, people that were not necessarily for nonviolence. But these were things were happening sort of simultaneously, throughout the country. But definitely sort of being connected to what was happening in the South.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, I think your analogy there in comparison to the war, the Civil War, being the Second Civil War, it was definitely a war we were in. I mean, we were dying.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really one of the things that was the spark around Freedom Summer to bring the young people down. And a lot of local people were dying, and the country was not giving any real attention to it. And so when Medgar was killed, which was one of the higher profile people to be murdered, we still were not getting the attention of the country in this. And then you have the March on Washington. And then you have the three the little girls killed in mm-hmm. in Birmingham. So you're still not getting the country to move. So we were thinking that the one way to get the country to move is to bring the children of the Constitution to Mississippi. And by doing that is we opened the door for the people in the country who really were. We thought the Constitution, we felt the Constitution was really written for because the country responded to them and not to us. If we got them in here, that attention into Mississippi, we could make a difference and expose the atrocities and how people were being treated just for trying to exercise their basic rights as citizens of this country. So we were in a debate about that. There were some people who were for it, and there were some people who were against it. In terms of when I say people, we're talking about primarily our staff
mm-hmm.
and local people of the NAACP and the staff of CORE and the staff of SNCC. And then January, there was this meeting in Hattiesburg. Is we going to do this? We were looking at several issues there. We would be needed to figure out a way to bring attention to what was happening to people trying to register to vote. We had to bring the attention to around the Democratic Party and its role in this is because the convention was coming up of the Democratic Party in the state of Mississippi was almost 100% Democrat
mm-hmm.
at that time. And so how can we do this and really make this, since the Democratic Party was saying that it was that they were putting themselves out as the soldiers and protectors and promoters of the civil rights for everybody. So here we are with this threat. And so we were still in a debate, though, was about this good idea, because people are going to get hurt and local people get hurt. and people in the staff and these volunteers to be exposed. So it just so happens that during that meeting, there was Lewis Allen, who's out of Liberty House, out of Macomb, and who was a witness in the murder of Herbert Lee that had been killed a couple of years earlier by a state senator. And so what we wanted to do was Lewis Allen had agreed to testify to the federal government, and the night before he was to leave to go to D.C., he was murdered in his front yard and assassinated. And so this happened during the meeting that we were having and this debate we were having in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And so at that time, that was the turning point, because at that time we decided we have no choice but to move forward with the of opening the doors, no matter what the cost was, what was happening in Mississippi, because that was the only way we thought would stop the violence. We really thought by doing this, though, that the federal government would come in and protect. I mean, this would force their hand to come in and protect. We underestimated the powers to be, and so, and the power of J. Edgar Hoover. And so what happened there is that Johnson then decided that they were not going to provide any protection for the civil rights workers, and I think it was in May, J. Edgar Hoover made the statement that they were not there to protect, and the federal government was not going to provide any kind of protection for people. And so John Doerr, who was with the Justice Department, assured us that there was nothing they could do. And so the after effect of that was that opened the door, and you now, later, you had, a few weeks later, you had the murder of Cheney Goodman Swerner.
Yeah. And you were supposed to be with them, right?
Yeah, we were. I had not gone to Oxford. Oxford was where they would have the training of the volunteers. And so core staff and SNCC staff were part of the training group to train these students. And so most of the people, staff, in fact, all of the staff just about, had went to Oxford to be part of this training because we had a lot of students, around 800 to 1,000 students. There. And so I stayed back to help to finish up the last minute preparations, making sure about it, housing, the watch line worked, dropping off sleeping bags, what we had to do. And I became ill at that time as I had gotten a bronchial infection. And so when Cheney, Ben Cheney and Mickey came back through to go to the church to Philadelphia.
And that was Mr. Dave Dennis talking about those events of 50 years ago. And we're going to continue that interview in a little bit. But I want to just reflect a little on a wonderful article in the ARP newsletter that comes out, I think it comes out monthly, and this particular piece was written by Alexandra Starr, and she is interviewing both Robert Moses and Dave Dennis about the title of the article is Second Acts 1960s Activists Become Today's Educators. Two veteran activists turned their purpose and passion to the Algebra Project, because we made mention of the Algebra Project quite a bit. This particular piece was written about, let's see, this is 2014. It was written 8 years ago now. And in it, she writes, when Bob Moses and Dave Dennis describe their roles in the 1960s voter registration drives in Mississippi, the reminiscences sound like war stories in the literal sense of the term. They were beaten, shot at, and narrowly escaped death. Close friends died. Herbert Lee, a farmer and father of nine, and the first black voter Moses got registered, was shot unarmed in broad daylight by a local politician in Amite County. Bronchitis, as he already mentioned, kept Mr. Dennis from riding in the car with three civil rights workers he was training, James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman, the night they were killed by members of the Ku Klux Klan on the back road in Neshoba County. Mr. Dennis delivered the eulogy at Chaney's funeral, and to this day he wonders if there was something he could have done to prevent the tragedy. In some ways, the United States has become a more equitable society as a result of the activism of the 1960s. And I'm thinking about the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act by President Johnson. And we actually talk about that, Mr. Dennis and I, in later on in our conversation. More than a quarter of Mississippi state legislature is now African American, and the state has the largest number of black legislators in the country. We're talking 2006, right? But access to the ballot box is not translated into providing true equality of opportunity. She quotes Mr. Dennis, "We've learned that a political voice is not enough. We need to get the target population into the economic flow," end quote. The key to realizing this goal, both men say, is high-quality education. So in the second chapter of their lives, Moses then 71 and Dennis then 65, are focusing their activism on expanding educational opportunities, or to be precise, providing a rigorous math education to disadvantaged students. Their enterprise is aptly called the Algebra Project. It began in 1982 when Moses, then a graduate student in philosophy at Harvard, was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant, freeing him from financial worries. Dismayed that his daughter Maisha's Cambridge, Massachusetts school didn't provide algebra in the eighth grade, he started tutoring her and two other students. Algebra is a gateway subject. Kids who take it middle school are more likely to be on college-bound track, a path minority students too often are dissuaded from pursuing. Plus, students who aren't math literate will be at a market disadvantage in a technology-based economy. To realize his hope of providing math education to marginalized communities, Moses started pulling together a curriculum that brought the subject to life by linking it to everyday experiences. To spread the program, Moses decided to adopt a bottom-up model. Participation in local sites would plan how to further math literacy in their schools and partner with Algebra Project trainers to make it happen. The project has mushroomed since Moses did his solitary tutoring in Cambridge. Today it has a budget of more than $1 million and is operating in 7 states and many major cities. As he explains his vision, Moses, who has a calm, almost yogi-like aura, frequently uses the phrase earned insurgency. In the 1960s, sharecroppers themselves had demand that the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which guaranteed them the right to vote, become more than an empty promise. Similarly, students themselves need to demand the right to a high-quality education, quote Moses. To get that, they have to think they can do it, says Moses. The Algebra Project works on that sense of empowerment. So to head up the effort to expand the project in the South, Moses turned to his old civil rights colleague, Mr. Dennis. Moses was with SNCC, founded as a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and Mr. Dennis with CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, when they met in the 1960s. The two men had different backgrounds. Moses was born in Harlem, was teaching mathematics at Horace Mann, an elite school in New York City, when he headed south in 1961 to join the Civil Rights Movement. Mr. Dennis arrived in Mississippi a little later as one of the freedom riders who were attempting to desegregate the interstate bus system. He had been raised in Louisiana, as he already mentioned, by sharecropper grandparents. So anyway, the two men, they reunited in 1988, in response to a rebuke of the film Mississippi Burning. And although Moses and Dennis hadn't seen each other in almost a quarter century, they easily fell into a conversation that stretched for an hours. So Dennis was happily practicing law in New Orleans at the time, but Moses's friend's purpose and passion recruited him into the Algebra Project. To the chagrin of Mr. Dennis's children, he relocated his family to Jackson, Mississippi in 1992 so he could dedicate himself to the new civil rights work. And that's around education and opportunity, because education is definitely the key out of poverty, even to date. And so he talks about that a little bit, Mr. Dennis does, in the conversation. And in this article, he says, the article says about under the demanding to learn algebra, that he points to the example of middle school students in Weldon, North Carolina, who demanded that the school board provide them with an algebra teacher. When the demand wasn't met, algebra project trainers worked directly with the kids on evenings and weekends. And at the end of the year, 85% of the students passed the state's Algebra 1 exam. Mr. Moses is convinced that students learn best with a program that taps everyday experience. So they start their studies going on a field trip in urban areas. They'll take the subway. In rural schools, they'll get on the bus. And then they distill their field-based experience into a symbolic representation, such as a map, a timetable, or a chart that shows how math concepts can help explain the world around them. The point is to get them to value reflecting as opposed to reciting, repeating, and memorizing, says Mr. Moses. He often teaches, but he also teaches algebra and geometry to 9th and 10th graders in Jackson, Mississippi. It keeps us honest, Moses told the AARP Live and Learn. The only way to know what we're doing is to be in the classroom, end quote. The walk and talk approach can also be traced to his 1960s work. One of the core parts of the movement philosophy was never ask someone to do something you wouldn't do yourself, says Mr. Dennis. But Moses and Dennis are in a period of transition. And then the article goes on to talk about Hurricane Katrina and how Mr. Dennis has devoted half his time to rebuilding the education system in New Orleans as project manager of the Vanguard Public Foundation. But he also speaks in our interview of how New Orleans, as of this fall, will be 100% privatized, which is a real catastrophe. So we are going to play another segment from the Freedom Summer film, which, again, I mentioned earlier. You can watch it on American Experience presently. It's screening. It's streaming online if you missed the national broadcast earlier this week.
Political participation was something reserved for whites. And if blacks sought it, they could get hurt in lots of different ways, ranging from economic reprisals, loss of jobs, or if you had a business, restrictions or being placed on your business, or if you had a loan, your loan being called in.
The common theory about Mississippi was that you could not attack Mississippi from the inside. It had to be attacked from the outside. You had to stand away and say, this is an awful place, and it ought to fix itself. But Bob Moses and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee said, no, that's not true. We can do it ourselves.
Bob Moses was a high school teacher in New York City. He went south in 1960, originally just feeling he had to go, had to get involved. SNCC sent him to Mississippi. He started going around on his own in the rural areas where people simply didn't go and challenge the status quo.
What made him stand out was not only his sheer courage, but his calm courage. I can't tell you that Bob Moses was afraid because he never showed it. He just went about his work, and there was this calm sense of mission.
Bob went over there by himself in 1961, and by the end of 61, maybe there were five or six SNCC people in the state. In 62, maybe there were 18, 19, and in 63, maybe there was 23, 24. When we'd have a staff meeting, we all fit in one little room.
Young people working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC as we call it, are characterized by a restless energy. They seek radical change in race relations in the United States. The world is upset, and they feel that if they are ever going to get it straight, they must upset it more.
So that was another clip from the film Freedom Summer. And we are going to continue with that interview with Mr. Dennis. We're going to take a little musical break while I get that ready for you. I think I finally have it together. So play something from McLee Hadaro, just because got that East Africa vibe going with, oh, you know what? I think I'll play another one from Ganji. Yeah, he's got a beautiful piece. His latest recording, let me find that. Oh, I think you'll really enjoy it. Just a second. I'm still here. I think I might play something for McLeod so I don't just have you hanging on, since I'm still looking for that piece that I wanted to play for you. I had a poem for you as well. I have to get to have all these things. in my mind. Almost there. Okay, here we are. This is one I really like, Look at What the Light Did, and it's by McLeod and Quinn, and then I'm going to play another one with just McLeod. She went on this, she did this work where she went to East Africa, and they recorded, they had like this big conference, music sharing kind of conference between artists here and artists there, and they collaborated on some pieces. And so I'm going to play something from that project, but I'm going to start out with Look at What the Light Did, and Mr. Dennis will be coming up as soon as I get it uploaded.
Look at what the light is now. be gentle. Be gentle, gentle with me. I feel a fragile this year. Be gentle, gentle with me. Me and the voice. This voice. I counted 10,000 walls around my heart now. Can't see my eyeballs, my walls. Some are made of cardboard and some are made of clay. Some are made of memories for that sad, sad day. Oh, I know every single one of my my walls. Oh, I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of them. I walk amongst them, in between them, shout from on top of my Some hold bones like graveyard stones, like fossils in the sea. Well, some are painted red for missing me. Well,
Daro Walls from her debut CD, On a Day Like Today, and I think she's on like CD 4 or 5 now, maybe more. however, that's, I really like that particular one. This is a poem that Rafael Jesus Gonzalez composed and sent me and some other lucky persons like myself, and I want to share it with you. It's called U.S. Independence Day. Oh, say, can you see? The liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any controlling private power. And that's President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Oh, say, can you see that these truths be sacred and undeniable, that we hold them to be self-evident, proclaimed by the rocket's red glare and the firecrackers in your ears, the smell of barbecue and hamburgers on the grill, the beer foam on your lips. We are told so as the Constitution is made confetti, And we praise the Lord for the money in our pockets and support the troops, our youth, because they kill bravely, die bravely, terrorizing the terrorists and torture the infidels who are jealous of our liberties. Oh, say, can you see? And again, that's Rafael Jesus Gonzalez, humanitarian activist poet who calls Aslan and California home. And this is also written in his native Spanish, but I'm not going to read it in Spanish because I will just not do it justice. So I'm going to play another song, and then we're going to get back to the interview. And this song is by Melamy, and this is his latest piece. Or maybe I'll get back to the interview and conclude with Melamy, so I don't disrupt the flow. So let me get back to the interview with Mr. Dennis. And then we'll close with, if we have time, a piece from Melamy, my dancing partner, which is just like so phenomenal. His voice is so beautiful, and it really shines in this particular piece, which is very different from Sons of Africa, which is also wonderful. yeah, a lot of the brave men and women of the Freedom Summer were sons and daughters of Africa. So, yeah, that piece is certainly apropos, but my dancing partner is also really beautiful. Okay, so let's try this, and hopefully, and there's a period of silence, not long, but, and then it picks up again. I don't know what happened. I'm still working on this technology here, a new program, so I'm trying to work it out. But you'll really enjoy this conclusion of this great conversation I had with Mr. Dennis.
More black elected officials who are elected as right. We have the right to vote. We have Mississippi has more black elected officials than any other place in the country. But at the same time, at the bottom of the totem pole, when it comes to education, when it comes to health care, when it comes to economic development. And so this is an issue here. And now we're having the same thing is happening, and we have in the major cities. We have blacks elected to mayor, what we have is, and most of these particular cities and places are going bankrupt, what we have is not because they are bad leaders or not good leaders. Mm-hmm. It's because the name of the game around the power base changed, and it shifted. So therefore, it needs more than just the right to vote, but now how do we use that right to vote? Because what happens is, whenever we become leaders in the city, there's what you call white flag, or the money leaves. The tax base leaves the city. The city does not have the income that it has economic support that it needs to be survival. So somebody changes the game. So you look at the way these things have been used, is, and our attention has been stopping, I think, as at a point whereby, without realizing that there's more to it to have the kind of power base that we need in order to have some control over our lives. So I begin to look at these things and turn them over here is, and I mean, in my head is, I call the 1964 Civil Rights Act is a great horse, but also is a Trojan horse of the civil rights movement as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. So this is the part where there's a little silence. Just hold on, and he'll be coming back in a few minutes. I hope it the volume comes back. Gosh. Can't hear it. Oh, darn. I'm not certain why the volume is like this. Okay. Well, we are going to stop this because you can't hear it. and we will try it again on Wednesday. The whole thing, I promise, it's the third try. It's got to be the charm. And so we're going to close with Melamie's, my dancing partner, his latest release. I think that's the title. Let me make sure that I'm telling you correctly. Let's see. Yeah, Dancing Partner. Really, really wonderful, wonderful piece. Like I said, it's the his voice is just lovely. Oh, my goodness. I hope he sings that tonight. So I am uploading that for you presently, looking for it in the stack, and I'll be playing it shortly. I appreciate your indulgence, Melamie. Okay, here he is, Dancing Partner. So as people go forth, as you go forth today, Independence Day, look at the beautiful fireworks later on tonight. Just think about people like Mr. Dennis and Mr. Moses and all of the hundreds and hundreds of volunteers that put their lives on the line, and some actually gave their lives for fellow citizens in the South to be able to realize a true democracy. And to date, those, that particular goal is not reached. So just think about that as Frederick Douglass's question, what to the American slave is the 4th of July, still resonates, unfortunately, with many of us.
Another, when I'm yours and you are mine.
that was one of the pieces I mentioned earlier from the Now Project, which Miklit Hadaro was a part of, I think it was a couple of years ago now. And that particular piece was Salam Nubia from Aswan. And in her libations, Nefertina's mother talks about Aswan and Nubia and Kemet, which is the name that Egypt was known as formerly. So I wanted to share that with you. And I'm going to close with another one, another piece from Project. And this one is called Tazeti. And I believe the Nile Project, I think they met, well, I'm not sure. I think they met actually in Ethiopia, which is Miklit Hadaro's native land. That's the land of her people.